From Nevada to Pennsylvania, Hawaii to West Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the U.S. and Iran stepped back from the edge of an all-out conflict as President Trump applies economic rather than military pressure. Here to take a look at how well that might work is Timothy Head from the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Public attention has been riveted on Iran and the ongoing impeachment saga. But behind the scenes, the healthcare debate continues. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Democratic presidential primary is turning into a battle of the billionaires as Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg spend millions flooding the airwaves with ads. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has analysis. And debate over the war powers of the president has reemerged in the aftermath of the drone strike that took out Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Donald Trump has decided to fight an economic war with Iran rather than to ratchet up military action. It builds upon a strategy that is already working. So says Timothy Head. Tim is executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, and he is here to discuss the latest developments. Tim, welcome to American Radio Journal. Tim, it has been certainly a week of major developments, one after another, relative to the United States, American policy toward Iran, and the extended conflict in the Mideast. As you look at the president's policies, Tim, and the fact that the president appears to be ratcheting down the war drums and aiming more at economic sanctions, I'm interested in your view as to how well you think that policy might work.
I'm very optimistic that it will work, partly because, frankly, it has been working and it is working. So part of the reason why Iran has had this kind of an increase of external activity outside of Iran is actually because internally, the citizens of Iran are making more and more noise against the current Iranian regime because of economic pressures. And they're aware that all of this global and international either legal, legitimate aid or illegal, illegitimate aid is being used by the Iranian regime to support other paramilitary or terrorist activity outside of Iran. So the economic pressure is actually, it's actually being shown to be effective even as we speak.
Looking at that economic pressure, Tim, you referenced the growing unrest inside Iran. The president ratcheting up sanctions. Is Iran really able financially to sustain an extended military conflict with the United States without having the economic situation internally deteriorate to the point that the regime could be overthrown?
The simple answer is no. They can't sustain a traditional military conflict or offense, which is the very reason why they resort to these terrorist paramilitary operations across not only in Iraq, but throughout the region and frankly, actually around the world, because they have the ability to do kind of micro-targeted terrorist attacks and occasionally missile attacks to strategic locations, either in the region or occasionally into North Africa, but they can't actually sustain a true military, either defensive operation or offensive operation.
In terms of what triggered the current round of activity over there, the United States drone attack that took out Qasem Soleimani, let's talk for a minute or two about that. The American left has been up in arms, suggesting that this was a provocative action by the president and shouldn't have been taken. Your view on that? Do you think the president was right in taking this terrorist out?
Well, absolutely. The sad reality is that there is evil in the world, and that evil is not just kind of a virtue or a byproduct of concepts or theories. It actually is incarnate. I mean, there are people who are demonstrated in the case of Soleimani over the course of over 30 years, just heinous activity towards Iranians, toward Iraqis, towards Syrians, towards other Muslims, towards Christians, really kind of unbridled evil. And there actually are a number of different folks around the intelligence operations around the world that have actually been monitoring opportunities to eliminate him for a number of years. The fact that President Trump, that he still was on the scene when President Trump even arrived in office 3 years ago is frankly not only unfortunate, but was literally deadly for a number of people in the last couple of years. So it was completely merited. I mean, his track record has been truly, literally one of terror across the entire world.
The Faith and Freedom Coalition, which you are executive director of, Tim, you sit at the intersection of faith and public policy and how our faith, how our Western values do impact and influence public policy. And you started talking a bit about this in your last answer, but I'd like you to amplify it a bit. Relative to calls from the left that, we need to negotiate with these people, we need to not do provocative actions, we need to not take out people like Soleimani. Is that country culturally very different than ours and really much of the rest of the world to the point where we can't expect them to conduct themselves in a manner that we would or our allies in Europe or Asia might, but they are just culturally so different that you have to have a position of strength in order to just get their attention?
Good question, and I think there are a couple of layers to that answer. First of all, it is true that throughout the not just Iran, but throughout the Middle East, if you will, weakness or passivity is definitely interpreted as vulnerability. And so, from a geopolitical standpoint, and from a negotiative standpoint, it is really, really important to show that you're a serious person. /entity in the case of the United States or Israel for that matter, but on a human level, I actually think that Iranian, just kind of the citizenry of Iran, their felt needs are exactly the same felt needs that any of us would feel. We want security and safety for our children. We want economic stability. We want basic infrastructure, water, healthcare, schools, et cetera. And the citizenship of Iran is being denied those things. And so on the one hand, for dictatorial regimes like we see in Iran, there has to be not just projected, but true strength. But on a human level, for all of the millions of Iranians, we need to be able to be compassionate, if you will, towards their needs and mindful towards those needs.
We have been talking with Timothy Head. Tim is Executive Director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, tell us a bit about the Faith and Freedom Coalition, also where folks can go on the web to learn more about you.
The Faith and Freedom Coalition is a public policy organization that comes from a biblical worldview and tries to find and support biblical values within a constitutional framework. Our website is ffcoalition.com for Faith and Freedom Coalition.
Timothy Head from the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He is keeping track of some upcoming movement in Congress that will be occurring relative to health care. Obviously going to be a big issue in an election year. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Of course, all eyes are on Iran, all eyes are on impeachment, but healthcare, Scott, continues to be one of the issues foremost in the minds of the American electorate. There is going to be, especially as we head into the early spring, some activity in Congress. So what component of healthcare is Congress going to be looking at?
Looking back to the 2018 midterm elections, Democrats have been laser focused on making healthcare a big political issue. And as they won the majority back, this has been one of those things that's dominated a lot of the conversation here in Washington. Certainly, Medicare for All has been a large element of that, but you also have a few other issues that are on the kitchen stove and beginning to boil. And so as we look ahead to 2020, I think it's worth giving the listeners a little bit of a preview and making sure that they understand what's happening. There's a big bipartisan proposal that has gone through negotiation through key leaders in the healthcare space in the United States Senate, Patty Murray from Washington State and Lamar Alexander from Tennessee. And this is supposed to be tackling the issue of surprise billing and medical billing. So often folks will go in for a healthcare service and be totally surprised. They'll have sticker shock when they see what the medical billing looks like. So their bill aims at fixing the prices that folks would be paying related to these services. The issue with this is that this is price fixing in health insurance, and it's really only something that the health insurance companies want. In the end, it's not good for patients, it's not good for doctors, and it's really not the solution that we're looking for when it comes to price transparency. On one hand, it's different if you've got, I think, what a free market proposal should look like related to prices, when individuals could shop around and know that if they need to have their gallbladder removed, they could get it done at one location for $15,000 or another location for $8,000 or maybe even another location for $4,000. And then they can do their own research, they can analyze data, and they can decide, you know, really the $8,000 cost is $4,000 more than the cheapest cost, but the quality of care is better. They have better ratings on the internet. However you want to look at price transparency, it's something that's supposed to empower patients. And the problem with the Murray Alexander proposal on surprise billing is that it's really a crony deal among health insurance companies that only is good for them.
There are some tax-related matters when it comes to healthcare that are going to have to be extended, decided upon. Tell us a bit about those.
That's part of the surprise billing negotiation, right? You've got a deadline looming in May of 2020 where the Medicare tax extenders that were agreed upon at the end of last year, those are purposefully expiring late this spring so that they can set up sort of a cliff and ensure that there is some action with a must-pass item. You know, I say must-pass like the end of the world will happen if we don't pass it, but in reality, this is what Congress does. They govern through crisis negotiation, and that's the strategy here in working with the health insurance companies to get the surprise billing proposal through. They want to attach it to a must-pass item like Medicare extenders, so we need to be watching closely to see exactly how that negotiation plays out. I think that there will be many conservatives that have strong concerns over the health insurance companies that are really pulling one over on the American people and on individuals and doctors. So we'll certainly be engaged on that issue with Club for Growth through our 501c4 and be talking through our membership and also through the members of Congress that we often communicate with.
On the presidential campaign trail, Scott, there's all this talk about Medicare for all. Is it just rhetoric, or is there actually any movement in Congress toward trying to draft legislation or to begin moving such a program, complicated as it is, through the halls of Congress?
You know, I'm tempted to try to impersonate Bernie Sanders, but I won't. but obviously, he has written the bill in the Senate. And there's other proposals that are floating around Capitol Hill related to Medicare for All. It's not just a talking point. This is the direction that they want to take health insurance. The first step was getting closer to a single-payer system, which is what the basic design of Obamacare does. It caused high number of participants in the health insurance healthcare marketplace to drop out and stop offering coverage to the American people, which allowed for prices to dramatically increase. And really, when you look at most states, they only have a couple of providers. And the mega providers that are in the health insurance space like this because they're seeing record profits. And if they ever incur a loss underneath Obamacare, they go ahead and seek a taxpayer bailout to cover their losses. So really, we need to decide, is healthcare something that government should make decisions related to? Is it something that health insurance should make the decision? Or is it something that patients and doctors need to begin reclaiming authority over. We obviously support free market reforms in the healthcare space that would dramatically increase choice and competition. I think that President Trump has done a decent job at expanding choice and competition in the healthcare marketplace through the HHS department by promulgating new rules related to short-term limited duration plans, association health plans, reimbursement health savings accounts, and even more than that. So obviously, if a Democrat comes in place and takes over 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, they can turn off those rules at HHS and decrease choice in the healthcare marketplace for people even more.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. So the Club for Growth is based out of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're a membership organization, and we're focused on economic liberty and freedom. So if your members are interested in checking us out, our website is www.clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer are flooding the airwaves with political ads as they seek to move into the top tier of candidates as the 2020 Democratic primaries are set to begin. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to discuss. Eric?
When Americans tune in to watch the Super Bowl next month, they will be subjected to a 60-second ad from New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg. Bloomberg, of course, is one of the two Democratic billionaires running for president in 2020, and he's dropped an estimated $10 million to purchase that 60-second slot during America's biggest sporting event. But the two Democratic billionaires, that's Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, are actually proving that money can't buy elections. Together, they've spent well over $200 million so far, and yet neither of them seems to be much closer to the White House. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at those two candidates, Bloomberg and Steyer, and the fact that they've spent, as I said, well over $200 million so far in campaign ads, and certainly many millions more to come as voting does not even begin for another month in the Democratic primary. But even though that amount of money might not mean much to them, the opportunity costs here are really quite staggering. No other candidate in the field through the end of 2019 had spent more than $18 million on ads. That's according to data that Politico aggregated last week. Bloomberg spent that much just in the first week that he was in the race, and he's kept up spending right around $20 million per week since he jumped in. But despite that huge advertising blitz, Bloomberg and Steyer are almost certainly wasting their money chasing political power. While it's foolish to rule out any sort of electoral outcome in this reality where we've got Donald Trump as president right now, voters have responded to both Democratic billionaires so far with a resounding meh. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of enthusiasm for either one of them, and there seems to be little reason to think that that will change any time in the next few months, no matter how much money the two of them pour into the race. There are actually two important lessons here, I think. First is that Bloomberg and Steyer seem to be on an inadvertent crusade to actually prove that progressive fears about the influence of money in politics are largely unfounded. Secondly, the two billionaire candidates are providing a real-world lesson about opportunity costs by setting fire to their huge campaign war chests. I mean, they've got the means to change the world. They are certainly wealthier than you or I, or pretty much anyone out there. But getting involved with politics really is not the way to change the world. Bloomberg has been spending close to $30 million per week on TV ads since jumping into the race, but all that cash hasn't really moved the needle. He's running a distant fifth in the Real Clear Politics polling average right now, with somewhere around 5%, a little over 5%. That's well behind more thrifty candidates like Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden, who continue to lead. He's unlikely to qualify for the next debate, which is scheduled for January 14th in Iowa, because Democratic National Committee rules require that candidates qualify via polling, which Bloomberg has done, but also by accumulating at least 225,000 individual donors, which he has not. In some ways, Bloomberg's self-financed ad-heavy campaign may not really care about the debates. In fact, in some ways, you could argue that he might be better off by skipping the debates and saturating the airwaves without having to face any of his challengers in the flesh, where he would probably be subjected to criticism over his wealth and his record of supporting stop-and-frisk policing in New York City, along with a bunch of other things. Now, Steyer has done marginally better, at least in terms of qualifying for the debates. He's been on the stage for the last three debates, but he seems unlikely to make this month's contest in Iowa. He's polling below 1.5% in the Real Clear polling average, and he doesn't have great numbers in any of the early primary states, not even in his home state of California, where you would think voters are at least more familiar with him. Given how Bloomberg and Steyer have struggled to gain traction, it's a bit ironic to hear some of the Democratic primary opponents repeatedly bemoaning the influence of money in politics. Senator Elizabeth Warren and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg got into a kerfluffle at the last debate over whose campaign was more corrupted by the influence of deep-pocketed donors. And the consensus view in the Democratic primary field is that Congress ought to overturn the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, the decision that the court in which the court ruled that campaign contribution limits for political action committees placed unconstitutional limitations on free speech. Now, it's certainly true that money can buy access and influence in the political process. There's no doubt about that. But when it comes to campaigns, money is really only as good as the results that it can produce. Joe Biden has had well-documented fundraising issues, but he continues to be the Democrats' frontrunner. Bloomberg is spending more each week than Buttigieg has spent so far in his entire campaign, but Mayor Pete is the odds-on favorite to win the first primary contest in Iowa, and Bloomberg is running well back in the field. In short, the idea that billionaires can buy elections is kind of being debunked right before our eyes, once again. And if they can't buy the election, couldn't these guys probably do more by not running for office in the first place? Take Steyer, for example. His entire campaign is built around a single idea. He says that climate change is America's biggest challenge, but also our greatest opportunity, because it means we'll have a chance to create millions of good-paying jobs across the country. Now, you don't need to be president to create jobs, and you don't have to agree with Steyer about climate change to see that there's certainly ways that he could make an impact without becoming president. One thing you do need to create jobs, for example, is capital, and Steyer clearly has plenty of money lying around. But solving climate change will require more than reducing Americans' access to energy. It will require big ideas and innovative thinking. Things like carbon capture technology, improved batteries, drought-resistant crops, and so on. Those ideas and products will almost certainly be developed in the private sector by individuals trying to make a buck, not forced by government mandate. And unlike most of us, Steyer is in a position to identify and support the companies that are most likely to make a real difference in reducing the effects of climate change or helping people to cope with them. But instead, he's dropping $80 million to $100 million so far in order to get his plaid tie into a few primary debates that few voters are going to watch and even fewer will remember. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the Democratic primary field, of the next debate in Iowa, and of all of the developments that we will see in 2020 as the race for the White House heats up. You can find all of that at Reason.com. And I'll be back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It has been decades since Congress updated the War Powers Act. It may be time to clarify the respective roles of Congress and the president in launching military action. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Was the drone strike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani an act of war? Since the Constitution vests the sole power to declare war in the Congress, did President Trump violate the Constitution by committing an act of war without congressional authorization? Well, a lot of hot political rhetoric has been spilled over the past few days on this issue, but very little of it or the news coverage of it could be described as informative. Let's try to unravel it here. There are three key statements of policy. The first is the Constitution itself, the second is the War Powers Act of 1973, and the third is the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2001. The Constitution divides the war powers of the federal government between the executive and legislative branches. The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, while Congress alone has the power to make declarations of war and to raise and support the armed forces. So when is a military action within the president's sole powers as commander of chief, and when is it an act of war requiring congressional authorization? That's the real question. The United States Congress has issued a declaration of war 11 times in its history. Three were in the 19th century against Great Britain, Mexico, and Spain in 1812, 1846, and 1898, respectively. In the 20th century, there were two declarations of war in 1917 against Germany and Austria-Hungary in what we now know as World War I, and six in 1941 and 1942 against Japan, Germany, Italy, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Romania. There has been no congressional declaration of war since 1942. So under what authority was our nation involved in wars in Korea, Vietnam, Grenada, Kosovo, Libya, Afghanistan, or Iraq, among others? As questions legitimately arose as to the extent of the president's authority to deploy U.S. armed forces into hostile situations abroad without a declaration of war, another form of congressional approval emerged. Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, or the War Powers Act as it's come to be known, in the aftermath of the Vietnam War to address the concerns of undeclared so-called presidential wars, to provide a set of procedures for both the president and Congress to follow in situations where the introduction of U.S. forces abroad could lead to their involvement in armed conflict. Note the use of language here. War, in its most conventional sense, is hostile action between two sovereign states. As various forms of military action have become more commonplace by what are often referred to as non-state actors, the language has morphed from formal war into a more basic description of armed conflict. The War Powers Act of 1973 was designed to reflect that reality and restore proper constitutional roles in light of present realities. It requires the collective judgment of both the Congress and the President to the introduction of United States armed forces into hostilities. It is within the context of that act that the authorization for the use of military force, or AUMF, in 2001 was passed. It's not complex, and it's quite specific. It amounts to congressional authorization to use our military forces to, quote, all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, or committed or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons, close quote. Does that legitimately still apply to our military actions in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now possibly Iran? Probably, but it's a bit of a stretch. Nancy Pelosi's threat to introduce an updated version of the War Powers Act, which most people see as an attempt to limit President Trump's power, should instead be seen as an opportunity to clarify and update the division of power between the president and Congress. And with a Democrat Party-controlled House and a Republican Party-controlled Senate, there's actually a potential for it to bring the sides together. Is such a thing possible in our increasingly heated legislative bodies? Let's hope that the new year brings some 2020 vision to bear on this important constitutional question. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WYHM-AM in Rockwood, Tennessee, KORQ-FM in Abilene, Texas, along with KLNG-AM in Omaha, Nebraska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.